This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Muhammad has not only been the center of Muslim discussions of prophethood, but he has also been the focus for many Christians as well. In The Christian Encounter with Muhammad, How Theologians Have Interpreted the Prophet, Charles Teason introduces a wide variety of depictions throughout history and assesses how Muhammad is used in the context of differing Christian doctrinal and social issues. His examples range from medieval Christian communities writing in Syriac to those living in Al-Andalus to West Africa and more. Across these case studies, Teason seeks to understand how the prophet was used to support, justify, or contest various positions both within Christian debates and broader interreligious exchanges. In our conversation, we discuss Christian writings about Muhammad from late antiquity to modern times, narratives about the Christian monk Bahira, John of Damascus, early Syriac texts, the martyr movement of Cordoba, Latin depictions of the prophet, Christian letters addressed to Muslims, Mary Fisher, the English Quaker who traveled to Ottoman Turkey, Samuel Ajayi Crowther, the Yoruba convert and West African Christian missionary, Professor of World Christianity Lamin Sane, and what these discussions tell us about Christian-Muslim relations. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. And now here's my conversation with Charles Teason about The Christian Encounter with Muhammad, How Theologians Have Interpreted the Prophet, published with Bloomsbury in 2020. Welcome, Charles. Thanks for joining me on New Books in Islamic Studies. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, appreciate it. I'm excited to talk about this book, The Christian Encounter with Muhammad. It's a great book. I think you do a really good job of kind of giving us a wide spectrum of perspectives. And it's got a very, very beautiful cover, which hopefully will attract people as well. Yeah. But before we get into the book, we always start with a little bit about our authors. So if you could tell us a little bit about your background, perhaps what brought you into Islamic studies, maybe mentors or moments that were influential in shaping the types of approaches or the texts that you use, what kind of brought you to your scholarship?
Right. I've been thinking about that, actually, how I got here. I was born in Montana, which really isn't what one would think of as the environment, you know, to launch a career in Islamic studies. But I remember this would have been in the early 80s, being taken by my mother to a wading pool. We were driving in the car, and a friend was sitting in the back seat. And he was just making jokes. And again, this was the early 80s, so something would have been going on with the civil war in Lebanon. And I remember he said something about hijacking our car and taking us to Beirut in the name of Allah. And as a young child, I had no idea what he was talking about. But for some reason, that moment stuck with me. And I look back on it now, slightly embarrassed at what was, you know, bigoted and not the best joke. But at any rate, I think I was left with questions about what was he talking about? Who was Allah? What did that have to do with the Middle East? And so those questions for a child in Montana kind of, I think even if subconsciously, started an interest and took me to a place of finding out more of what was being talked about. I ended up in college in California as a religious studies major. And I remember about, must have been halfway through my degree, about the time when, at least in the American system, you begin taking courses in your major, the college hired a new faculty member whose focus was Islamic studies, in particular Muslim communities in Southeast Asia. And maybe because they were new courses she was teaching, I'm not sure, but I started taking them and was fascinated just with the content. And I think maybe it was starting to help me understand questions that I had had, again, both consciously or maybe subconsciously in my mind. And that was kind of the start, pretty much in college. From there, there was a little break. I got married and whatnot, and I actually ended up in seminary. So I have a background in Christian theology, and I think maybe there was thoughts at the time of pursuing ordination of some kind. That didn't happen. But I remember even in that context, you know, learning Christian theology and Christian history, what interested me more was when I would learn about contexts in which Christians and non-Christians were coming in contact with one another, or Christian ideas, how they were received by non-Christian communities. And so this kind of interreligious context interested me, you know, more than just learning straight dogmatics. And even the context of Eastern Christianity was more interesting to me, for whatever reason. And so I began to kind of focus more of my studies in what you might call Middle Eastern Christianity at the time. I planned to do a PhD at the University of Edinburgh with someone who was there at the time, the late David Kerr. He ended up moving to Sweden. And so I planned to go there, but my wife was also studying at the time and they didn't have a program in Sweden that suited her needs. And so we ended up in England at the University of Birmingham. And I did my PhD there with David Thomas, who's now retired. And so that kind of, I started with, you know, childhood questions and went from there into how some of those questions interacted with different religious communities, and ended up doing a PhD in essentially the history of Christian-Muslim encounter.
Hmm. Now, you've written a bunch of stuff, some of it intersecting with this book in terms of some of the broader themes. Can you tell me a little bit about how this project started to emerge as a book and how it relates to your broader research trajectory?
Yeah. So, you know, from the start of my doctoral research, the broad topics were just the history of religious ideas, particularly the encounter of between Christians and Muslims. As I said, I was working with David Thomas, who's perhaps best known for the research project CMR, or Christian-Muslim Relations, a Bibliographical History. That project started, I think, maybe 2006, and right around the time I arrived in England to study. And so I kind of was following that project as a doctoral student and helping here and there. Eventually, I became and am now one of the section editors of that project. And so from back then up until now, a lot of my work has been looking at the ways in which Christians and Muslims have been interacting and the textual evidence to support what we know about those interactions. And so a lot of my work has touched on specific aspects of that history. Some of it has led to, you know, books about to help teach those kinds of things. So whether it's I have a textual history of Christian-Muslim relations, which collects primary sources for teachers and other things like that. But part of it as well, with that, the CMR project, you're kind of analyzing texts that are coming from, you know, the full sweep of that history and across geographical contexts. And as a result, you know, you keep seeing similar themes pop up. And so part of my interest has been to look at themes that are more significant than others and kind of gauge the continuity across geographical contexts or across time periods, or, you know, where there's discontinuity or difference, how can we account for that? And so, you know, the book before this book, I wrote on the topic of cross veneration, how Christians venerate the cross, why they do that, and the conversations Muslims and Christians would have about that topic. That was interesting to me because it wouldn't be the first topic you'd think of when you think of, you know, Christian-Muslim discussion. And yet it kept coming up, text after text after text. And so part of my interest was to look at, in that book, that topic, but in other topics as well, how these discussions open up over time. I moved from that to another topic, which was how Muhammad, the Prophet Muhammad, is described as the Paraclete. And that is still an interesting topic and I think worth more research. But as I was looking at it, it, you know, just quickly became bogged down with the redundancy. You know, it appears a lot in lots of different texts, but oftentimes the same argument is, you know, written over and over again. So I kind of got bogged down with that and set it to the side. Meanwhile, you know, this other question of whether it's coming from Muslims or within Christian communities, you know, what do Christians say about the Prophet Muhammad, or what can they say? This is something that comes up again and again, even in, you know, textbooks that are currently written. If it's on Christian-Muslim relations, you have to have a chapter on this topic. And I even, you know, compiled a book of those theological topics in which that was one of the chapters. And so I began to think, well, maybe this is another topic where I can look at how that question was answered or how it was even asked across the centuries and in different geographical contexts.
So this one specifically kind of came out of that work. And you start almost at the beginning in the sense that you focus on a familiar character to those that know the Muhammad's biography from Muslim sources. You look at this Christian monk, Bahira. And I'm wondering if you could help us think about him from the way Christians were talking about him. What was his story? And then how did Christians in the early period use this story about him?
Right. So he's kind of a common character in lots of different texts. And the way he's used as a character kind of depends on the Christian tradition of the author who's writing. And so if, you know, say among East or West Syrian authors, or even among Greek Orthodox authors, this monk will become kind of the theological opponent. And so in, you know, a text by John of Damascus, this monk is an Arian. So he's always a heretic, in other words, or usually is. And part of the reason is he's serving as a way of explaining how Islam came about. And so one easy way of doing that is to identify a kind of heretical influence to account for the ways in which Islam might be similar to Christianity, but the ways in which it's significantly different or even subtly different. And so this monk becomes this point of influence where he's not only the reason behind the Quran or what Muhammad had to say, and so that in itself kind of eliminates the notion that the Quran might have been sent by God or might be God's word. It's actually the ideas of a Christian monk. And it also helps to explain why they're divergent from a particular community's views of, say, Christ or whatever theological doctrine it might be. So it's a way of accounting for difference and for the existence of something. It can even be used to say, why is Islam here? Why is it continuing? Why does it seem to be successful among different communities? And that can be used to reflect perhaps back on one's own community and say, well, it's for our own sin. Or perhaps if we had our beliefs, held them more firmly or more accurately, then we might be better able to counter these heretical beliefs, whether they're found in another Christian tradition or in another religious tradition entirely. So this figure ends up being a creative means by which to do that in all sorts of different genres, whether it's polemical texts or apologetic ones or in apocalyptic texts. And in this first chapter, I do look at really his appearance in apocalyptic texts. He's picked up all over the place. But in this chapter, I try and look at texts that are apocalyptic in nature and where this kind of original strain of the story emerges and then kind of develops.
You have a chapter that focuses on John of Damascus, who you mentioned just briefly here. People have probably heard about him, but can you give us a little background on who he was and the context he was writing? And then how did he view Muhammad? What were the ways he talked about him in his writings?
Right. So John grew up in kind of an elite family in Damascus. It's thought that his father and grandfather probably worked for the Umayyad government and probably were part of that transition in the early development of Muslim communities and Muslim rule in that area. And so as an elite person, he likely knew Greek well, and by this time probably knew Arabic as well. And so he was possibly familiar, if not certainly with Muslim people, but also probably with the sources they were working with as well. And so he writes this actually a really lengthy encyclopedic text, part of which is a heresiology or a collection of heresies, which was not an uncommon thing to write at the time. And Islam appears as the last among this list of heresies, which is also a common technique used not only to kind of provide an updated list, but the last one appearing as the sort of tip of the heretical spear, if you will. And so as an early text coming from the 8th century, it's often seen as it is an important source for what Christians knew about Islam and Muslims. It's often used in that way to show what they knew. And if you read the text or the portion that John devotes to Islam, it's, highly anti-Muslim, highly polemical. And so it's often used to show what Christians didn't know about Islam and about Muslims, or to show an agenda that they had for at least combating Islam through literature. And that there's certainly, it does kind of, those sorts of things are evinced in the text. But I think if you perhaps dig a little deeper or consider how John is developing his thoughts, a lot of what emerges is his familiarity with Islamic sources and the ways in which he was probably having the information in those sources filtered through conversations with Muslims. The result that comes out of the other end, of course, is still something highly anti-Muslim and highly polemical. So what he did with this information is perhaps different than how he was receiving it. But what is interesting, I think, and what I tried to show in this chapter is how he was interacting with Muslims who were clearly having a discussion about how to interpret passages of the Quran. In this chapter, I think portions of the second surah appear. And you see kind of the early development of the Quran kind of as a canon, and how Muslims were interacting with interpretation or interpreting the text. And then once it gets in John's hands, he uses that with an agenda to essentially discount Muhammad as a prophet. And so it's not so much that Islam is perhaps a lie or Muhammad is a completely false prophet, although he does use that term. But what you see is this attempt to kind of subordinate Islam and Muhammad as inferior. And so he's able to acknowledge that Islam is not a set of pagan beliefs. It is, in fact, monotheism, a belief in one true God. But the ways in which it deviates from true religion is kind of what makes it inferior, and in turn, what makes Muhammad an inferior prophet. He may have been a prophet, he may have achieved certain things, but it falls short of a Christian ideal, for John anyway.
And this is, I think, one of the strengths of the book is you provide a whole spectrum of Christian perspectives, right? You show the variety of Christian perspectives. And this, I think, comes through really strongly, actually, in the next two chapters in the book, chapters 3 and 4, where you're looking at different Syrian Christians and how Muhammad is depicted in early Syriac texts. So can you just give us a little bit of background on who East and West Syrian Christians are, what the differences might be, what's the environment they would be encountering Muslims? And then how did they talk about Muhammad? What were some of the differences between the texts coming from these communities?
Right. Well, first, perhaps it'd be helpful a bit of background of why I thought to include those. I think I was interested in including sources from these perspectives anyway. But as I was writing, in fact, I was working on the book and it was even in contract. I then learned that John Tolan, who many are familiar with, I'm sure, had just published a book in French at the time on this very same topic, basically how Christians interpreted the prophet Muhammad. That eventually was translated into English and put out by Princeton University Press. And it's a good book. At first, I kind of panicked because I discovered, he's just written the same book that I'm that I'm writing. And I know John, but not well enough to where we would have had this discussion. So when I saw at least the French version, I noticed, of course, as he would do, given his expertise, he really focused more on European views of Muhammad or European Christian views of Muhammad. And there's some reflection there on Eastern sources, but more how they were influencing these European views. So I breathed a little sigh of relief and kind of adjusted my kind of table of contents. And that kind of made these East and West Syrian sources all the more important, at least in the context of my book, because this whole Eastern set of images, if you like, is not one that's often covered. It is in various sources, but they're not usually collected like they are, or like I attempt to do in this book. And so, yes, you have essentially East Syrian authors and West Syrian authors. These are terms used to essentially reflect different liturgical concerns or different liturgies. And they also reflect the different Christian traditions that are kind of divided along Christological lines. And so some other terms, you might have terms like Nestorians, who would be East Syrians, or Jacobites, who would be West Syrians, or Monophysites or Miaphysites. These terms that we're essentially using East and West Syrian are used to describe these two different communities. They're Syriac speaking communities or Syriac reading communities, but are divided along these lines of Christological dogma. It is more complex than that, actually, but that's the essential kind of dividing line that you see on the surface. But oftentimes their texts are much earlier than a lot of the other texts where we read about Christian views of Muhammad. Geographically, they're situated in areas where Islam was spreading early on. And so the kinds of interactions we see are relatively unique, not entirely unique, but at least relatively so. Michael Penn is another scholar who really focuses on these sorts of texts and has done a lot of good work about the uniqueness of these communities. What I thought was interesting about them in general was they do a really good job of problematizing the notion that Christians only had bad or very terrible things to say about Muhammad and the prophethood of Muhammad. Because often in these texts, especially the East Syrian ones, they have things they admire about Muhammad. They have lots of good things to say. We have to kind of unpack those concepts to really understand them. But it's a very different view of Muhammad than what we might be used to seeing with, say, John of Damascus or a lot of the European views of Muhammad, at least medieval ones. And so you have people like the patriarch Timothy the First, or you have a lot of anonymous East Syrian writers who are describing, disputations they had with Muslims. Whether those are real or not, it is open for question. But even when they might be literary devices, they usually reflect very authentic contexts where Christians and Muslims were having these very robust theological discussions and debates, but in the context where there's a lot of assumptions of shared values or shared religious values. As probably one of the most well-known, at least in terms of scholarship, most well-known ones comes from Patriarch Timothy the First, who, when asked by the caliph, what do you say about Muhammad? He has this kind of very eloquent passage in which he says, Muhammad trod in the tracks of the lovers of God. And so admits this shared monotheism, this shared love of God, this shared sense of a prophetic value in nature, which again is, there's lots to unpack there, but when you put the pages side by side with something like maybe John of Damascus or some of the other, West Syrian authors, for instance, there's a remarkable difference. And so part of what I wanted to do was kind of, again, problematize our assumptions when it comes to Christian views of Muhammad or the history of those ideas, and also kind of push some new thinking with regards to some of these authors. And I think try especially to show what appears to be a kind of a shared tradition across these different, between East Syrian and West Syrians, perhaps, where they're drawing from very, if not actual sources, at least shared traditions about how to think about Islam, how to think about Muhammad. And so you see these kinds of views that track across centuries and across different texts. Where you have, they're not only unique views, but the fact that they appear consistently within these Syriac texts, I find quite interesting.
You move from this context to Spain in the next chapter, and you look at a martyrs movement in the 9th century. And Muhammad kind of plays an interesting role in how these Christians are being portrayed and in terms of their motives and actions. So can you tell us a little bit about this Christian community that you focus on and or these Christian figures and how Muhammad kind of fit into the narratives of their martyrdom?
Yeah. I mean, it kind of known popularly as the Cordoban martyrs, or it's a topic that, I suppose it would be a bad pun to say it's a topic that's been fairly well beaten to death in scholarship. And sometimes it's been, used to show, or defend the position that Christians and Muslims are inevitably in in conflict with one another. You know, so look at these Christians who were executed almost not in mass, but in large numbers by Muslim leaders. So you have that line, or essentially using it as a way to describe the ways in which Christians and Muslims, in this case in 9th century Al-Andalus, interacted. So that you've had a lot of really not very good scholarship and even popular level writing on it. And then, of course, there's been other sides and a lot of work done to really understand it better and problematize it and kind of see this movement in the context of certain kinds of writing, which is really trying to at least mimic hagiography and trying to portray a Christian community that was mirroring the early Christian martyrs, say, who were reportedly killed in the Roman Empire. So what actually happened in 9th century Al-Andalus, we can't entirely be sure. Most recently, Christian Sonner has done a lot of good work on the topic and trying to put it in the context of understanding martyrdom. And again, hagiography, I'm looking for the book to remember the title of it, because I can't, where is it? Well, Christian
Sonner.
That's
why we have bibliographies, right?
Yeah. Anyway, he's done a lot of good work to really problematize how we understood martyrdom and what it was. This a movement of people who got together and decided to go to a mosque and insult the Prophet Muhammad in front of Muslims and therefore be martyred? And were they trying to push back against culture, a change of language and culture? Was there something else going on? Because if you read the texts about them, and there's very few really, and they're really only written from two different Christian individuals who were involved in this movement. Again, they're very highly polemical, highly anti-Muslim, and a lot of it is really a collection of telling the stories of these people in order to cast them as saintly figures who were martyred. And in the process of that, we get these reflections of how they were, their views of Islam, their views of Muhammad. And so in the context of this kind of hagiography, where they're trying to defend these people as saints, you have Muhammad come in as a figure who is essentially a foil to these people. And so he becomes a kind of anti-saint. And the Quran and Islam, or what they knew of Islam, is again a kind of very negative foil to a pure religion or Christianity. And so not only do I try and get at one view of Muhammad that appears in a set of Christian texts, but some of the claims in these texts are, you know, incredibly, again, very anti-Muslim, but almost outlandish. And, you know, one of them even claims that, according to Islamic tradition, Muhammad said he would either marry the Theotokos or the Virgin Mary in paradise or take her virginity, which is a, you know, a wild claim, very salacious. And I mean, even for those who might read it today, but certainly for anyone, however few they may have been who read these texts, this would have kind of been the nail in the coffin when it comes to considering the validity of Islam or Muhammad. And in scholarship, a lot of people have just used this to say that this is the first time such a claim appears and it's completely ridiculous. I think actually in my first book, which was based on my PhD thesis, I think I kind of joined in that claim. But it's another example where if you dig a little deeper, you actually see the author, in this case, his name is Eulogius, is actually appears to be familiar with Islamic traditions. Not that said that, but where the Muslims are discussing the hierarchy of Muhammad's wives in paradise and, you know, who comes first and what's sort of the lineup in terms of precedence. And here you have a Christian who somehow reads that or overhears these traditions being discussed and either bungles it or deliberately bungles it in order to create something, you know, much more terrible than what it is. But what it shows is, instead of this idea of Christians being completely unfamiliar with Islam or Muslims and then just making stuff up, that does happen, but maybe not always, or at least like we would think. In this case, you have Christians who are familiar with Islam, but not handling it well, or deliberately mishandling it in order to create an image of Islam or Muhammad that would kind of ensure, or they, at least they hoped would ensure, that would drive Christians and Muslims apart, which at least for these authors who are making an account of the Ordovan Christian community seems to have been their goal, was to push people apart.
You also have a chapter here on this really kind of interesting a Latin text, which is a translation of an Arabic text written by a convert. And there's kind of this strange relationship between the two texts themselves, but then you're able to kind of bring them together through your own analysis. What's going on with these texts? Because they seem rather unique. How does Muhammad fare within their description? What's the relationship between the two? What kind of differences do we see between these, the original and the translation?
Yeah, this is coming from chapter 7 of the book, where I'm discussing a Latin text called, well, the short name for it is the Liber Denudationis, or the Book of Denuding or Exposing, in which the author is trying to essentially expose Islam or the Prophet Muhammad for who they really are or what they really are. And this is, it's been in a lot of texts that have to do with medieval Spain and Al-Andalus, because we thought that this is where the text originated from. It seemed clear that it was a translation in and of itself from an Arabic original, but there's no copy of this Arabic original. And so it was always thought that someone within medieval Spain, likely what might have been called a Mozarab, or a Christian who was an Arabic speaker and influenced by Arabic and Muslim thought forms, had written this text for a Christian community in medieval Spain, who was also Arabic speaking and whatnot, as a way of making sense of their context. And eventually it was translated into Latin. I was actually using, sort of going along those lines in my own thinking as I was writing this chapter, because he does make some interesting claims about Muhammad and kind of uses this common technique where in kind of modern parlance of the literature we might be used to, he kind of unveils Islam or unveils the Prophet for who he really is. That's why I was including it. But it was actually at American Academy of Religion, conference. I ran into a colleague, David Bertena, who mentioned that he was looking at this text too, and he had found the original author who wrote it. And it was something very different than what most scholars who are working on this thought. So there's just an example of why it might be good to network and go to conferences. You discover things that you, at least for, it's kind of a nerdy discovery, but it was really a fascinating one. And so what David Bertena has shown, and he has shared this information, some of it he's not yet published, but he showed that basically an Egyptian convert from Islam to Christianity had written this polemical text. And just through networks that go across the Mediterranean basin, had been picked up and ended up in medieval Spain. And it's likely that someone there who read Arabic and was familiar with Islam picked it up and translated it for a Latin reading community. And also took a lot of liberty in his translations and added a lot, took away a lot from the original text. And so there's a much sharper polemical edge to this Latin translation than what occurs in the original Arabic text. In both, Muhammad is discounted as certainly as the final prophet, and Islam as a religion is put in context as a inferior set of beliefs when compared to Christianity. But in the Latin translation, this becomes, I would say, much more harsh. And so the line dividing Christianity and Islam, or the line dividing a true prophet from one who is not true or a false prophet, is made much more stark. Why was this done? We can only speculate, but it would just seem to reflect the perceived needs of a certain community to whom the translator was providing this text, which is often, really one of the conclusions, not the only one, but one of the conclusions that comes up, I think, consistently in the book, is that these images of Muhammad don't work really well as sort of windows through which to view who Muhammad was or how to understand him, but really are better mirrors reflecting a particular author's concerns or a particular set of concerns in one specific context and community.
In the next chapter, you shift in terms of audience for the writings that you're looking at, in the sense that you move to some letters addressed to Muslims themselves. So can you tell us a little bit about the depiction of Muhammad in these letters? What might they tell us about Christian-Muslim relations at the time? And what was the reception of these letters?
Right. So this is a man named Paul of Antioch, who writes a letter as an account for a trip he took in order to discover more about Islam and provide more information about Islam, which was a letter that was picked up later in what the edition that we know it as is the letter to the people of Cyprus, which then was circulated among Muslims, some particular notable ones like Ibn Taymiyyah and al-Dimashqi in Damascus, of course. And so here you see a lot of times, these texts are meant for internal consumption. You have a Christian, for example, writing about Islam or writing about Muslims, and you're tempted to think that, Muslims are reading this and might respond. And oftentimes this just isn't the case. They're writing for fellow Christians. But here are a set of examples in which texts were written and sent to specific Muslims who then responded directly to the texts. And so it's a really interesting example where there's an authentic exchange going on, and you can kind of see it almost in real time as there went back and forth, not back and forth, but as one reached out to the other and the other responded. In all cases, the Muslims who responded were not convinced by the claims and, thoroughly denounced them. Essentially, on the surface, what the original letter from Paul of Antioch was arguing was that Muhammad may have been a prophet or was a prophet, but only really for the Arabs. And so there's a sense in which this sounds very, appreciative, but the context is that his prophethood was meant for the Arabs. Anything that he had to say, Christians already were aware of. And so it really kind of stanchions off what Muhammad's prophethood meant. And the other bold claim is that when read correctly, which meant when read by Christians, then the Quran could be most accurately understood. And then these letters proceed to do that and kind of show the true meaning of various passages of the Quran. And of course, when the Muslims picked that up, they responded, very harshly, kind of really, really putting those claims into context and denouncing them. But in either case, Muhammad is not this universal prophet, but in the Christian texts, while he is acknowledged as a prophet, it's really only for a specific community. The effect of that is that Muhammad brings Arabs closer from further away from paganism, closer to monotheism, and in so doing does a kind of Christian service by bringing them closer to the ability to believe in Christ as Christians understand him. So it's a very creative set of arguments, but one that was not at all convincing to the Muslims who read them and responded.
You move on to a really interesting person named Mary Fisher, who was an English Quaker who traveled to Ottoman Turkey and led what seemed like a fascinating life. Can you tell us who she was? What's her story? And then how it was remembered by others, because this is part of the story as well.
Yeah, this was part of my effort to transition kind of beyond the usual set of geographies and languages that we refer to in topics of this nature and kind of push it out into a different areas. It was a challenge because while there's evidence or, you know, Christian texts that discuss Muhammad from, you know, all different regions at this period, the New World or in, you know, South Asia, Southeast Asia, a lot of times the claims they're making are the exact claims that we've read before. And sometimes they are, you know, directly quoting or copying, you know, let's say John of Damascus or other authors that are much better known. And so with Mary Fisher, it was interesting because she has a kind of a fascinating story, but it also brings in Quaker thought or early Quaker thought, which is, I felt, unique. And then, she has this encounter with the Ottoman Sultan at the time, which is, it frankly would make an interesting film. It's just an almost ridiculous story of, not ridiculous, but just crazy where she went and the kinds of encounters she had. Essentially, as a Quaker, as a very early Quaker, she was a part of a community that was considered Christian dissidents, or a heretical sect, you might say. And so they were often persecuted and squelched for their beliefs, which, deviated in various ways from, at least in those contexts, mainstream Christian belief. And so at the time, the Quaker view of the Holy Spirit and the ways in which individual Christians or individual Quaker Christians or friends, as they were known, could function as prophets and mouthpieces of God, you know, and it didn't matter who you were or your gender. That's just how the Spirit operated. This was problematic from a Christian perspective, or from at least, you know, the Church of England's perspective, for instance. But then that filtered over into the New World and the American colonies, where these Christian dissidents may have gone to, but were also the larger community tried to put them down as well. And so you have a context in which, in the Quaker context, the idea was to go to the whole world with this message and with these sets of beliefs. So the fact that Quakers found themselves in the Ottoman Empire is not surprising. You know, that a woman, in this case, Mary Fisher, found herself there is also not surprising. But it's very intriguing that she did find herself, you know, kept going and in the company of the Ottoman Sultan himself, where they had this discussion about Islam and Christian beliefs. And of course, the question came up, well, what do you say, Mary Fisher, what do you say about Muhammad? And her response was he a prophet? Essentially, sure, because we all can be, but we really will only know the value of their prophetic nature by the fruits of their lives or their message. And that's where she leaves it, and that's where at least the account of their discussion ends. I think that in itself is kind of adds an interesting element to this story of what Christians had to say about Muhammad, and it's kind of a perspective that gets picked up here and there, especially at least in the last 50 years, where Christians are trying to think about what makes a prophet and what doesn't make a prophet, and how can that apply to non-Christian figures. But then in this context, the ways in which this very good-natured exchange is between Mary Fisher and the Sultan is used to kind of show the ways in which non-Christian communities could be very tolerant of those who with whom they didn't share a religion. So Muslims, in this case, tolerated a Quaker. And if that can happen, then surely it could happen in the American colonies. Or if even the Sultan can be tolerant of and kind to a Quaker woman, then what does that say about the Church of England or the wider Christian community in the colonies? How terrible must they be if even, you know, this Ottoman Muslim can be tolerant? And so again, you have sort of Muhammad and the questions surrounding him. He often gets conscripted by non-Muslim communities into all different kinds of service, whether they're battling, you know, a heretic or a dissident, or often just used in ways that, I mean, the intent was never there, but taken outside of a Islamic context is become something altogether more than what he was originally.
You move from the Quakers to a Yoruba convert who became a prominent missionary in West Africa. This also was a really fascinating story. Can you tell us about this person, Samuel Ajayi Crowther, and what was his missionary effort all about, and how did his knowledge of Islam and Muhammad shape his activities?
Right. So he was born and emerged in a context where there were Christians, there were Muslim communities, and there were communities of what he would have called pagan communities or indigenous religionists. And so certainly part of his knowledge came from this context. But he became a convert in part as a result of the slave trade. I'm not suggesting that's a positive result of the slave trade, but just that's the context in which it occurred, in which he was captured and then escaped and eventually became a convert within the context of the Church of England in West Africa. And so a lot of his training and education came from a Christian context. And so as he looks at the non-Christians around him, the Bible as a source for not only apologetics, but for truth becomes paramount. I mean, that likely reflects kind of that Protestant context, but it just in terms of a context where books have prominence in terms of knowledge, the Bible became the source that he felt people needed to argue from or go to as a source of truth. And so he often used this in his discussions with Muslims, and it even becomes the source he uses when with respect to the question of Muhammad. And again, you see this idea where Islam and Muslims become resources that push people towards something. And so in this West African context, it took people from quote unquote pagan backgrounds and pushed them closer to at least a monotheistic background. And so Islam, Muslims, Muhammad could be credited with that. But in order for the true flowering of humanity, that's seen with Christian truth. With Crowther, he comes about this, he really, not only does he depend on the Bible as a source, but the angel Gabriel is quite prominent in his strategy. And he really pulls this from a translation of the Quran by George Sale, who not only translates the Quran, but provides a lengthy introduction to that. And Crowther is pulling this idea from there, where he's using the angel Gabriel as a source of not the revelation, but as a source of God's revelation. And so if that is the source, what exactly did the angel Gabriel say? For Crowther, the truth of that message is found in the Bible, not in the Quran. And so the result is a way of discounting Muhammad once again, but done so in a very different way and in a very different context, even though some of the transmission of that knowledge, again, pulls from a long history, whether it's coming from England or, you know, by way of other sources that are much older.
Yeah, and the last chapter is interesting. It was a little unexpected, but I was glad you brought it in because you focus on Laman Sané, the professor of world Christianity who passed away not too long ago. And it's interesting to kind of read his life and scholarship in the context of this idea of kind of a Muslim-Christian encounter. So can you tell us a little bit about his background and role as a scholar, and then how did Muhammad factor into his writing and his ecumenical efforts?
So Lamin Sané was a West African who, a Muslim, who grew up as a Muslim and then converted to Christianity later on in life. And then, you know, moved throughout, you know, to the UK, and then eventually lived on the East Coast in the United States, and was a scholar, as you said, of world Christianity. But because he started as a Muslim and kind of took this very interesting path of exploring religious truth, and especially in the context of scholarship, and then really trying to find a, I don't know if this is the right way to put it from his perspective, but trying to find a religious home when he became least more convinced of a Christian perspective. And then, you know, was it Roman Catholic or was it Methodist? And, you know, eventually he became a Roman Catholic. But in the midst of that, not only is there a context of non-Western Christianity that is at play, but certainly his background as a former Muslim and the context of West African, or the practice of West African, of Islam in West Africa. What's interesting for him is the ways in which biography comes into play. So he used, in his analysis, at least of Islam and of Muhammad, he not only uses his own biography as, you know, how he engaged Islam and Muslim traditions growing up, but then really pulls in the way in which biography and the biography of the Prophet functions in Muslim communities as a way for understanding him, the Prophet. And in doing so, he does something that is almost entirely unique, not completely, because it's touched upon. I try and mention this in the conclusion of the book. A few ways in which earlier authors kind of touched upon Muhammad's life as a source of direction for Muslims, but it really is only very subtle until you get to Sané, and then it becomes a focus. Unfortunately, you know, he really only addressed it in, I think, two essays. And I had had conversations with him, but when I came to this work and read it, it was at that point that he had passed on. And so I was definitely left with questions that I would have liked to have talked to him about and gotten some more detailed answers beyond the two essays he wrote. But certainly what is significant is the ways in which he felt that the life of the Prophet, as you can see it in the Sirah and other Muslim sources, you know, Hadith literature and whatnot, really, as Sané put it, made Barakah live. It essentially made virtue come alive in the lives of Muslims and those who were trying to emulate the Prophet. And that's certainly a feature that's just not at all emphasized and usually outright ignored by Christian sources. The result for Lamin Sané was that the life of the Prophet became for him a signpost toward Christ. And so what he does with this biography is something that most Muslims wouldn't and or wouldn't want to have happen. But he ends up seeing Muhammad as a point of grace. It's just that that is a point that's directing him towards Christ, towards a Christian understanding of Christ. And so, you know, there's, how do you exactly, do you balance that? That's something that I wasn't able to discuss with him, because on the one hand, you have this really vigorous interaction with who Muhammad was for Muslims. But on the other hand, using it as a way of invigorating Christian thinking. Is that something that's in, you know, there's a deep tension there, or is that just a very creative way of, an ecumenical or an interreligious way of doing things? That's, you know, I'm not sure what he would have had to say about that, but it's at the very least one of the most unique approaches to this Christian question, at least what do we say about the Prophet Muhammad? One of the most unique approaches that I was able to find. And for that reason, I wanted to include it. And of course, because of the way Laman Saneh represents a very unique global perspective that helped to kind of bring together perspectives coming from what we would call the Middle East and those traditional, or what we would think of traditional sources, and kind of pulling those through different geographical regions and time periods, kind of back through from west to east and back again, kind of.
Yeah, it's a nice way to bring the book to the basically the present moment as well. So congrats on this book. It really, I think, complements the other literature out there on these kind of east-west Muslim-Christian encounters. So I'm glad you kept with it even after discovering the others are out there.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about some of the things you might have been working on despite our troubled times, things people could be looking forward to, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, yeah, despite our troubled times, huh? I, like so many people, I've had to be creative about where scholarship fits, in the context of pandemic. So in addition to that scholarship, I've also become an elementary school teacher, as I'm, handling virtual school for our children. And it's only very rarely do those things overlap. Sometimes they do, actually, which is always fun. But it's been kind of an interesting job to rethink how we juggle those responsibilities. But I still am involved with the CMR project, Christian Muslim Relations, a Bibliographical History. There's still a handful of volumes yet to come out. And so we're working hard on that to get those finished within the next couple of years. As part of that, there's a volume called, it's thematic essays. So for those who are familiar with the CMR series, there was already a volume of thematic essays treating themes that emerged in the history of Christian Muslim relations from, I think it was 600 to 1600. And so I'm working on the second volume, along with another colleague. I'm working on a second volume of thematic essays to bring it up to 1914. So that should be coming out soon. This book, The Christian Encounter with Muhammad, is one. Of course, it's coming from my life as a historian, but as I've used it and in classes, it's provoked interesting responses among students. And oftentimes, one of the questions that those discussions end with is, well, what do you think about Muhammad? I'm not a Muslim, yet I'm teaching these things, and so we're going through what others have said. And so I'm often left with that question. And I've also been challenged with with Laman Saneh's perspectives, as for me, as someone who, even though I'm a Christian, I live in a kind of the world of Islamic studies. What do I do with the overlap and also, distance in those two worlds where it may or may not exist? And so I've been thinking a lot about, you know, the ways in which Muhammad's life might invigorate barakah or virtue in me. And in a sense, what do I as a Christian historian or as a historian who, you know, is operating from that perspective religiously, what might I say about the Prophet Muhammad? And, you know, there's certainly so much that comes out of whether they're short essays or there was a book that came out recently by a systematic theologian addressing that topic. And so in one sense, I don't have, I don't think I have the best word to say, and now we can put a cap on it. But I am trying to enter that conversation, not as a way of continuing it and trying to bring some historical perspective to bear upon it. And I think one of the things I learned in the book was how even in some of the most, where there's evidence, where there's a lot less vitriol and a lot more admiration for the Prophet, there's a lot of ways in which he becomes Christianized by authors who are attempting to think about him and understand him, or perhaps even use him for whatever reason. And I think in our contemporary context, scholars can be much more attuned to the ways in which we might colonize a text or colonize a tradition. And we're loath to do that. But I find that that remains still the result sometimes of our scholarship when, at least in an interreligious context, we almost inevitably end up colonizing things. Is there a way, I'm wondering, in which we can have these interreligious discussions, especially where there might be room for appreciation, in which we approach them as guests instead of as, at least unwitting, colonizers. And so my work, when I'm able to tend to it right now, has been to think about the ways in which a historian can be a guest of the traditions of Muhammad and what results from that. And the easiest thing for me to do is to, you know, and as most scholars, is to think my way through that in the context of a monograph. But, you know, since no one reads those, and certainly no one buys them, and that's, you know, that they, those have their place, but I'm trying to rethink another way of communicating scholarship as I'm doing this, and through different types of literature. So I'm trying to write in a new way, I suppose, as I'm trying to think in a new way as well. And so that's what I'm working on, and I hope that has a place to come out in the next few years, along with these CMR projects as well.
It sounds like a worthy project to pursue, Charles, and I wish you the best. I hope you do figure it out, and I look forward to seeing the fruits of your labor. Thanks again for taking the time to talk to me about The Christian Encounter with Muhammad, another wonderful book, and thanks for being on New Books in Islamic Studies.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation, and I'm a listener, and I really appreciate what you're doing and what others are doing with the project as well. So thank you very much.